Welcome everyone to the Iron Rod Podcast. This is Chris. He's Taylor. This is episode 164. How you doing, Taylor?
I'm doing great. It's a sunny day in the Northwest, a rare thing in the wintertime. I'll take it any day of the week. Cold but sunny. So kind of like those bright days there in Happy Valley, Utah. Oh, you're north of Happy Valley. Sorry, you're in the Gentile Valley of Salt Lake City.
That's right. I did get some skiing in yesterday, so can't complain.
Yeah, you were telling me you got those heated boots to keep your toes nice and warm.
Did, and yesterday was the first time trying them, and they worked wonderfully. So good
okay. Investment. I will have to look into those because I hate cold feet and I get them all the time. But I'm not having cold feet about today's episode.
Nice lead in. We got kind of a mishmash today of different stuff that's happening at the end of 1835. And the first thing we want to start off with is section 101 of the Doctrine and Covenants. Asterisk.
Double asterisk. If you go to the RLDS version of the Doctrine and Covenants, you will still find section 101 in their version of the Doctrine and Covenants.
Well, that's because they're an apostate religion and they have false doctrine included, which, of course, if you take that position, then the Mormon Church from 1835 to 1876 was an apostate church with false doctrine as well. So,
I'm anticipating a good discussion about section 101, this false doctrine you claim.
So this is an article on marriage, and yes, it was included in the 1835 Doctrine and Covenants, and it was left in the 1844 Doctrine and Covenants. And then in 1876, when what we know as section 132 today was added, this was removed because those two doctrinal truths could not coexist. So one had to be removed to support the other.
Kind of like the lectures on faith.
Exactly like the lectures on faith.
Continuing revelation gives us some new doctrine and it contradicts old. We just have to excise the old from our scriptures and claim modern day revelation.
And so the question is, the faithful member of the church who believed that old doctrine, are they now apostates? Once the doctrine has been changed, or were they actually good, faithful people, even though they were believing false doctrine? This starts off, according to the custom of all civilized nations, marriage is regulated by laws and ceremonies. Therefore, we believe that all marriages in this Church of Christ of Latter-day Saints should be solemnized in a public meeting or feast prepared for that purpose.
Wait a minute, we don't exclude people who are unworthy to come participate in this particular ceremony?
That right there should tell us volumes. There's no feast in the temple. There's no public meeting in the temple. In fact, you know, the criteria is set by the church as to who can attend and who can't attend, completely contrary to what was in published scripture for 40 years.
And there's no special person who has the sealing power who's supposed to solemnize this marriage. It goes on that the solemnization should be performed by a presiding high priest, bishop, elder, or priest, not even prohibiting those persons who are desirous to get married of being married by other authority. I think that refers to like justice of the peace or anybody that the law would recognize as having authority to solemnize marriages. We believe that it is not right to prohibit members of this church from marrying out of the church if it be their determination so to do. But such persons will be considered weak in the faith of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. This is so different from the doctrine today. Somebody who does not get sealed in the temple would be viewed as weak in the faith. And yet all they're saying is have it performed by someone of authority in the church. But not even in the temple.
Right. And that is consistent with what the church did in the 1830s. These marriages were parties. People would get together, they'd perform the ceremony, and then they'd celebrate with drink and cake and
wine.
It was fun. Yeah. It was a fun gathering where everyone was invited. It wasn't exclusive and everyone talked in whispers and things like that. It was a time of rejoicing and celebration.
Yeah, and I've shared an experience I had with a Christian wedding where that actually happened, and it was a wonderful occasion. And I look back on that and say, you know, I wish my own marriage had been that sort of an affair.
Verse 2, marriage should be celebrated with prayer and thanksgiving, and at the solemnization, the persons to be married standing together, the man on the right and the woman on the left. Wait, I thought they were supposed to be kneeling across the altar in a Masonic grip.
Nope.
I can see why they pulled this out. The person shall be addressed by the person officiating as he shall be directed by the Holy Spirit. Wait, doesn't he just have a memorized prayer that he recites? The same for everyone? And if there be no legal objections, he shall say, calling each by their names, you both mutually agree to be each other's companion, husband and wife, observing the rites belonging to this condition, that is, keeping yourselves holy for each other and from all others during your lives.
That would seem to exclude polygamy.
Yeah, I'm curious about when you start taking on polygamous wives, how you answer that, keeping from all others that aren't also your wives?
All others except all the others you're married to.
Yeah. And when they have answered yes, he shall pronounce them husband and wife in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, and by virtue of the laws of the country and authority vested in him, quote, may God add his blessings and keep you to fulfill your covenants from henceforth and forever. Amen. I don't remember hearing that when I got married in the temple.
No, and this covenant here is a covenant to keep yourselves holy for each other during your lives. And there's no till death do you part, but it seems to be a marriage for time. I remember reading in the history of the church, Joseph saying he hopes that he'll be Emma's in a future life. And this was obviously before Nauvoo. But back then, they believed that it was for this life and that they should keep themselves for each other for this life.
The other thing I'll just point out here is nowhere does this document state that marriage ceremonies are appointed by God or by revelation. The very first sentence, according to the custom of all civilized nations, marriage is regulated by laws and ceremonies. And then by virtue of the laws of the country and authority vested in him, the marriage is solemnized. So this seems to be indicating this marriage tradition we have. It's based on the cultures and the laws of the countries in which we live. He doesn't seem to be making a higher appeal that there is one divinely approved way to celebrate a marriage or to perform a marriage.
I think it's important to at least observe here that historians think, from what I've read, that Oliver probably penned this. It's clearly not a revelation. It never claims to be a revelation, but it's a statement of policy of the church and their views on marriage that was then canonized and accepted by all of the quorums and the membership as a whole to be binding upon them at that time in 1835, which was one of the reasons that was used for taking it out. Oh, it was never a revelation. Here's the real revelation, section 132.
And as with the lectures on faith, Joseph had the opportunity in 1844 to remove this if he found it so offensive to the true doctrine, and he let it stay.
Yeah, and if he's teaching polygamy and letting this stand, what does that say about the contradictions? I mean, that's pure hypocrisy.
Yeah, if he had received further light and knowledge, he should have immediately gone in here and yanked this out. And yet he didn't put the polygamous doctrine into the 1844 Doctrine and Covenants, and he left the monogamous doctrine where it was.
Yeah, I think that screams volumes about what's going on. So let's keep going. Verse 3, the clerk of every church should keep a record of all marriages solemnized in his branch. All legal contracts of marriage made before a person is baptized into this church should be held sacred and fulfilled. So you don't need to get remarried by somebody in the church just because you got married outside the church. And then we have this. Inasmuch as this Church of Christ has been reproached with the crime of fornication and polygamy, we declare that we believe that one man should have one wife and one woman, but one husband, except in case of death, when either is at liberty to marry again. I read that and I put it in context of history of 1835. And at that point in time, it was clear that there was some issue with polygamy in the church. And I dug into this a little bit more, and maybe you found some additional details here, but the Cochranites who lived in Saco, Maine, many of them converted to the church, but they had polygamous marriages. And some of them continued in their polygamous marriages, even though they moved to the Kirtland, Ohio area. Brigham Young was known to go to Saco, Maine and preach and spend time there. We don't realize how much of an influence this polygamous group, I mean, they even use the term spiritual wifery. And I think that infiltrated some of the church, and maybe that's more of the background that is referred to here.
Yeah, that's absolutely what I take away from it, because polygamy did not originate with Joseph or Brigham. Other people were practicing it before then, particularly this group in Saco, Maine. And Brigham liked to go preach in Saco, Maine, and often would request to go by himself. I don't need a companion. Let me go to Saco by myself and preach out there. So it would appear that some of these people and these beliefs from Saco were trying to encroach on the church, and they're saying, no, polygamy is a crime that reproaches the church, that brings contempt upon the church. And of course, 10 years later, it's the complete opposite. No, that is enlightenment, and that's what blesses the church, and that's what makes us holier than all the other Christians. Stark 180 in 10 years.
And I think it's important to remember that the Lord had already revealed in section 42, his law, and reiterated in section 49 that marriage was to be between one man and one woman. That is the Lord's law. So this
Taylor,
is
Taylor. It's between one man and at least one woman.
At least.
You can't see it, but if you get a magnifying glass, okay. If you get a microscope, okay, if you get a scanning electron microscope, then if you look really closely, at least is actually written there in between. Well, you just can't see it with your naked eye.
Oh, really? That's like me telling a girl that I could kiss her, but I wouldn't really be kissing her because the nuclei of the atoms will never touch.
Yes, that is true. Totally true. No sin has been committed.
Oh, yeah, you can tie yourself up in knots.
Just like you said, in 42 and 49, very clear language, one man should have one wife and one woman, but one husband. There is no allowance for multiple wives or multiple husbands, both of which were practiced in the Nauvoo era.
Right. Well, let's finish this one off. It is not right to persuade a woman to be baptized contrary to the will of her husband. Neither is it lawful to influence her to leave her husband. All children are bound by law to obey their parents, and to influence them to embrace any religious faith or be baptized or leave their parents without their consent is unlawful and unjust. We believe that all persons who exercise control over their fellow beings and prevent them from embracing the truth will have to answer for that sin. Familial ties are important, and breaking up families is not good here. I think that's what it's saying. Because you can see situations where a woman wants to get baptized and she leaves her husband for the sake of the gospel and marries somebody else. That never happened in the church, did it?
The funny thing is it's so prophetic, because that's exactly what happened. They start sending missionaries over to England. They're looking to score some extra wives. They convince these women, leave your unbelieving husband and come to Zion with us, and you'll be sealed to a believing man. And that's okay. It's okay to abandon your husband because you're following the truth. Not according to this.
And by the way, all you 12 who are over in England, you know, leave some of the good looking ones for us who are back in the United States. Don't just take the very good looking women for yourselves and send us all the ugly ones. That's not fair. I laugh about it, but there are actually letters telling them to do this.
It's really sad. Well, I can see why in 1876 they felt it necessary to rip this out of the canonized book of scripture and pretend as if it had never existed in the first place. Here we are in 2022 with the church still believing that, and most people completely unaware that this was ever in the scriptures.
Don't look there because it contradicts further light and knowledge. Only focus on the further light and knowledge, Chris.
And that leads us to section 134, which was section 102 in the 1835 Doctrine and Covenants, and pretty much the same type of document as the Article on Marriage. It wasn't a revelation. It was really just a writing of accepted beliefs and such at that time. And yet all the arguments that are used to discredit the Article on Marriage are never used on section 134. We never poo-poo it and say, oh, this wasn't really doctrine. This was never intended to be anything. This was actually just a rogue committee. Joseph never approved this. Both these documents were submitted at the same time, and neither were revelations from Joseph.
When I read through section 134 this time, I took the effort to look at what it was teaching and then line it up to where our government is today. And it's an interesting exercise that we'll go through to just show how far off we are in terms of the true principles of a government that respects our rights and preserves the peace. Verse 1, we believe that governments were instituted of God for the benefit of man. So God allows governments to be set up to help man, and that he holds men accountable for their acts in relation to them, both in making laws and administering them, for the good and safety of society. Well, I thought it was just for the elite few. No, it's for everyone. And that's the basis upon which our U.S. government was set up. We believe that no government can exist in peace except such laws are framed and held inviolate as will secure each individual the free exercise of conscience, the right and control of property, and the protection of life. Three key principles there. Where are we today on those?
These are the inalienable rights that were the basis of the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution. Free exercise of conscience, the right and control of property, that once I own something, you can't tell me what I can and cannot do with that. And then the protection of your own life. You need to protect me from bad people. As soon as we start straying away from that, we start encroaching on the lives of other people. We should give something free to this group. Well, the only way you can give something free to someone is to take it from someone else. So now you're in violation of the right and control of property. So when you really boil it down to what the Lord is saying governments are instituted for, it seems to be saying they're there to protect these three inalienable rights.
And it says no government can exist in peace. You look at the disorder or the lack of peace in our society, free exercise of conscience. I mean, we live in a PC world. Some people's opinions or views are put down, and we don't respect free opinion, free exercise of conscience like we should. Look at property restrictions. I mean, if I buy a piece of property, I have to rent it from the government for the rest of my life paying property taxes. I can't do whatever I want with it. There are restrictions that are placed on the use of that property. And then you look at the breakdown of law and order in society where, you know, in the inner cities, you even have police departments that are saying, oh, we can't come to your aid. You know, call 911 and you're on hold for 30 minutes or whatever else. And so we're seeing this breakdown of law and order, basically these three things that are breaking down in our society today.
Leading into verse 3. We believe that all governments necessarily require civil officers and magistrates to enforce the laws of the same and that such as will administer the law in equity and justice should be sought for and upheld by the voice of the people, if a republic or the will of the sovereign. We have laws that are often not administered in equity and justice. They're applied selectively depending on what outcome they want and who is under the microscope. And if you're in one group of people, well, we're going to be really tough with you in the law. And if you're in a different group of people, well, you know, we've got a lot of freedom here. We don't really have to enforce the law as written.
Yeah, I live in a greater metropolitan area of a prosecutor who refuses to enforce certain laws. And guess what? People go scot-free for destroying property because they're, quote, exercising their rights, yet they're breaking the law. You have to have equal enforcement of the law to have peace and justice, equity and justice, it says.
In verse 4, we believe that religion is instituted of God and that men are amenable to him and to him only for the exercise of it, unless their religious opinions prompt them to infringe upon the rights and liberties of others. My gosh. I just look here in Utah. The dominant religion has decided that for them, drinking alcohol is a sin. And so they have crafted the laws to prevent as many people as possible from doing that because they want to impose their religious opinion on others. You know, we complain when we see over in the Middle East when that is done to Christians and to Jews. Oh, that's terrible. You know, why would they force them to do stuff that they don't believe? And yet we turn around and do the exact same thing here.
Yeah, you're right. Control other people. Superimpose your view on the populace.
We do not believe that human law has a right to interfere in prescribing rules of worship to bind the consciences of men, nor dictate forms of public or private devotion. That the civil magistrate should restrain crime, but never control conscience, should punish guilt, but never suppress the freedom of the soul.
So is drinking a crime?
That's a really easy one to see here in Utah, where they're just like, we are going to make it really hard for people who choose to drink alcohol to do so. That's the most visible example, but we could go through the list. There's all sorts of other things where things that are frowned upon by the church magically get enshrined into the Utah code that aren't enshrined in other states' code.
Right. Civil magistrate should restrain crime but never control conscience, should punish guilt but never suppress the freedom of the soul. You look at our society today, and we're getting very close to the idea of thought crimes. If you don't buy into the truth, then suddenly you're on the outs. And there's this effort to control thought. We could go into examples here in the pandemic, many other examples. But you know what Joseph and those who drafted this are focusing on is, look, judge people by their actions, not by their thoughts. They have freedom to think the way they want. And if what they're thinking about is incorrect in your view, convince them with evidence that it's incorrect, but don't control their conscience. Don't deprive them of rights because they have a certain point of view. And yet in our society, we're getting very polarized to where we're brittle as a people, and even the younger generation, you know, they've been indoctrinated, many of them, to view things one way, right and wrong, black or white. And if you don't agree with that, then you shouldn't be part of this society. It's actually quite scary. And yet what the true principle here is, think what you want. We will judge you on your actions. If you commit crime, that should be punished, but not what you think or what you talk about. You know, let's have a robust debate about it. That's okay. But if you commit a crime, it should be punished. Today, if you're on the right side of the thought police, you can commit crime and not be punished.
That's true. It gets back to the earlier one. You know, it's got to be administered in equity and justice.
So verse 5, we believe that all men are bound to sustain and uphold the respective governments in which they reside, while protected in their inherent and inalienable rights by the laws of such governments, and that sedition and rebellion are unbecoming every citizen thus protected, and should be punished accordingly, and that all governments have a right to enact such laws as in their own judgments are best calculated to secure the public interest, at the same time, however, holding sacred the freedom of conscience. Public interest, freedom of conscience. It's not private interest. It's not the interest of a few. It's not the interest of a favored group. It's the interest of everyone equally, including the freedom of conscience. That's what I take out of that. Equality.
The one topic for debate here would be at the beginning, where we're obligated to sustain and uphold governments which protect us in our inherent and inalienable rights, and that if we're thus protected, that kind of rebellious conduct is unbecoming. So then that just raises the question.
It begs the question.
At what point am I no longer protected? I think we put our blinders on in the Mormon Church, and we only look at the U.S. and we say, they won't allow me to go do X, Y, or Z. And you know, that's it. This is intolerable. This is tyranny. Have you guys looked at China? Have you looked at what's happening in Russia? Have you looked at what's going on in the Middle East? Even the worst day here in the U.S. is still a freedom park compared to what's going on in the rest of the world. And then dial the clock back 100 or 200 years. Oh, my gosh. I mean, there was real tyranny back then. I know there's like this, what is it, Desnaz? It's this very militaristic Mormon group, you know, looking forward to, you know, toppling the government and setting up a true theocracy here in the West. It's like, you guys have no context. Yeah, things aren't as good as they used to be, but compared to the rest of human history, we're still in a great position.
And if those guys would actually read the word of the Lord and the scriptures and how things are supposed to play out in the last days, it's not going to be by force of arms. It's going to be through the Lord that the Lord's enemies are wiped off and Zion is established. So the idea that we're going to attack the government, I mean, I think that just is further polarizing to our society. Make your best argument and fight for it in the arena of ideas, not with swords, not with spears. I think that's what we're talking about here. All right, verse 6, we believe that every man should be honored in his station, rulers, and magistrates as such, being placed for the protection of the innocent and the punishment of the guilty, and that to the laws all men owe respect and deference, as without them, peace and harmony would be supplanted by anarchy and terror. So I read this and I ask myself, is our government protecting the innocent? Is it punishing the guilty? Because if they don't, peace and harmony are going to be supplanted by anarchy and terror. And we've seen some of that with violent protests and other things that go on. And we excuse some of that behavior because it's PC.
And I'll just play devil's advocate here. On the flip side, we have abuse of police power and unjustified killings. And those officers are also allowed to walk. And so the innocent are punished and the guilty. So yeah, it's on both sides. And then to throw in a third perspective, and then we have the government passing laws on how much water your toilet can use.
Like, right. Yeah.
Wait, we've got like real problems here. Why are you?
Or what kind of light bulbs you can put in your house.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. It becomes more and more intrusive. And I totally agree with you. I'm not trying to say that there's one side or the other. All crime should be punished, whatever it is. Anybody who treats another human being with violence and disrespect, physically hurting other people, should be punished, period. End of story. There's no excuse for it, because we can't have peace unless those laws are equitably administered.
7, we believe that rulers, states, and governments have a right and are bound to enact laws for the protection of all citizens in the free exercise of their religious belief. But we do not believe that they have a right in justice to deprive citizens of this privilege or proscribe them in their opinions, so long as a regard and reverence are shown to the laws, and such religious opinions do not justify sedition nor conspiracy.
So if the IRS is going after a particular group because it doesn't like their politics, is that proscribing them in their opinions?
Oh, and now you're getting into a sticky situation, because I would argue if a religious organization has voluntarily subjected itself to the IRS by becoming a 501c3, you just gave yourself a new master and you need to do what the IRS says. But yeah, if there are religious groups out there that haven't gone the 501c3 route, I actually honestly think that right now there isn't a whole lot the government can do, because if they're not looking for the tax benefits, then there's really not much that the government can do to stop those people.
Right. And I'm really talking about where the powers of government are brought down upon a particular group based upon their views. And I think we see more and more of that. The prosecution or the persecution of a particular group, because, again, their opinions or their views, their held beliefs are not in line with the beliefs of those who are in power. Opinions are fine as long as it does not justify sedition or conspiracy, right? Violence. As long as you're not promoting violence under the garb of religion, you're okay.
We believe that the commission of crime should be punished according to the nature of the offense, that murder, treason, robbery, theft, and the breach of the general peace in all respects should be punished according to their criminality and their tendency to evil among men by the laws of that government in which the offense is committed. And for the public peace and tranquility, all men should step forward and use their ability in bringing offenders against good laws to punishment. Unless the criminal is an LDS leader who's also a pedophile. In that case, keep your mouth shut.
Or another way to think about this is, if you've got a prosecutor who refuses to prosecute crimes, then all good people should rise up and vote the sucker out of office. Because we're complicit. I mean, we get the government that we deserve. And when the people vote for individuals to lead them who will not enforce laws, who refuse to punish those who are criminals, then you get more crime. Don't prosecute crime, you're going to get more crime. And unfortunately, we see that. We see more and more an unwillingness to punish crime. Continuing, we do not believe it just to mingle religious influence with civil government, whereby one religious society is fostered and another proscribed in its spiritual privileges, and the individual rights of its members as citizens denied. We believe that all religious societies have a right to deal with their members for disorderly conduct according to the rules and regulations of such societies, provided that such dealings be for fellowship and good standing. But we do not believe that any religious society has authority to try men on the right of property or life, to take from them this world's goods, or to put them in jeopardy of either life or limb, or to inflict any physical punishment upon them. They can only excommunicate them from their society and withdraw from them their fellowship. I think this harkens back to what was going on in England not so many years previous to this. I mean, even my ancestors who were Protestant fled to the New England area from the ruling Catholics in England who were persecuting Protestants.
I guess this rules out the Salem witch trials. Can't burn the women for being witches anymore.
Been a dark time, you know. It seems like we're reverting back to some of that in some forms. So verse 11, we believe that men should appeal to the civil law for redress of all wrongs and grievances where personal abuse is inflicted or the right of property or character infringed, where such laws exist as will protect the same. But we believe that all men are justified in defending themselves, their friends and property, and the government from the unlawful assaults and encroachments of all persons in times of exigency, where immediate appeal cannot be made to the laws and relief afforded. The laws of the state that I reside in, where you have to be in fear for your life before you defend yourself, and it's got to be your life, not your property. And yet this seems to say that in times when your property or your life is threatened, one or both then you have the right to defend yourself.
Yeah, I think that would get into a discussion about when we say property, what do we mean? If someone's coming to burn your house down and you're inside the house, that's one thing. If someone's coming to steal your TV,
yeah,
it's an inconvenience, but
yeah. We have the right to defend ourselves in times of exigency, which means when the police can't get there, when there's no help from the government to protect. Anyway, I'm talking way too much about kind of current stuff, and we can kind of leave that. But I can just see how we've strayed from the principles associated with what Joseph's writing down here.
And then to close it up, verse 12, we believe it just to preach the gospel to the nations of the earth and warn the righteous to save themselves from the corruption of the world. But we do not believe it right to interfere with bondservants, nor preach the gospel to, nor baptize them contrary to the will and wish of their masters, nor to meddle with or influence them in the least to cause them to be dissatisfied with their situations in this life, thereby jeopardizing the lives of men. Such interference we believe to be unlawful and unjust and dangerous to the peace of every government, allowing human beings to be held in servitude. And I find this to be very carefully worded, because it's really saying don't upset the social order when it jeopardizes the lives of men. You know, there were a lot of abolitionists in the area. There were abolitionists that were joining the church. It isn't saying slavery is awesome and it's ordained of God. It's saying that it's governments that allow human beings to be held in servitude. But it's also saying we can't go out and really upset things because those slaves' lives are in jeopardy. We can't run in there, get them all agitated, then they all get killed and we run back up north and go on living our lives. So that's the way I view this one, looking back in hindsight, because now we would just say this is untenable. But back then, it was a very delicate situation with real life or death consequences.
And I had the same reaction that you're expressing here, Chris. And Chris, I had the same reaction when I read this. I think it's an acknowledgement of the status quo and the legal basis for slavery in certain states, but it's not a defense of the practice of slavery. It's not saying that we approve of slavery. It's saying we disapprove of interference with slaves in as much as it's legal currently in this country to have them, or in this particular state, because it was state by state at that point.
As disagreeable as it is to us today, the slaves were property. And these previous ones have said you can't interfere with someone's property, even if they shouldn't be his property.
In that sense, this statement is very consistent. It's internally consistent. Right. Stick with the laws of the land. Try to change them if you can, but don't do it through violence or sedition.
Well, that ends section 134. Those two sections were sections 101 and 102 in the 1835 Doctrine and Covenants. So the last thing we want to cover today is a special blessing from Oliver Cowdery for Joseph Smith. Now, there isn't a lot of information about this event. It was September 22nd, 1835. In the patriarchal blessing book, where lots of patriarchal blessings were written, this blessing for Joseph was written, and Oliver Cowdery wrote, "I greatly desired to know the mind of the Spirit concerning this my brother, with whom I had labored so many years. And accordingly, I besought the Lord with prayer and fasting, who opened the heavens upon me. And thus, while in the heavenly vision, I wrote the following blessing, which is a part of that which was shown and declared should come upon my brother." So there's no indication of whether Oliver actually verbalized the blessing at that time or laid his hands upon Joseph's head. We're not even sure if Joseph was there when Oliver had this vision, but he did record it in the blessing book, and we have it to read today.
I would actually title this as a vision of Oliver Cowdery, a prophetic vision regarding Joseph by Oliver Cowdery, as opposed to a blessing. Because as we go through this, we'll see that none of the promises, or very few of the promises, were ever fulfilled during Joseph's life. When I stumbled upon this years ago, I was blown away as to how it indicates this second commission of Joseph's that he will fulfill at some future time. And we'll see as we get into the text that there's just no way. It did not happen during Joseph's mortal appearance.
So it starts off, "Blessed of the Lord is my brother, for the integrity of his heart and the steadfastness of his soul. Upheld by the arm of the Almighty, he shall never fall, but shall be strengthened by his right hand till he overcomes. Like Jacob of old, he shall wrestle with the angel, and as a prince, he shall have power with God and shall prevail." So yeah, the first thing that I come to is, this is in 1835, sometime after 1835, Joseph is going to wrestle with the angel like Jacob of old. Did Joseph prevail on June 27th of 1844? He did not. People would look at that and say, oh, it's a failed prophecy. But the question is, if he's restored to life by the Lord and then continues where he left off, wouldn't that actually be a fulfillment of that? Wouldn't that astonish his enemies? Wouldn't that undo what they thought they had done?
A strange act indeed. "Ever faithful to his friends and true to his word, the goodness of the Most High shall sustain him, and thousands shall stand up to defend him from the hand of his enemies, and put forth the hand and ward off the blow, were it needful. But ere his foes are aware, he shall be hid under the pavilion of the Lord Jehovah. For with the voice of his thunder shall he strike terror to their hearts, and with the wings of an eagle shall my brother be carried beyond all harm by the power of the anointed. From amid the burning bush, like Moses of old, shall he hear the voice saying, I am the God of thy fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I have seen the afflictions of my people, and am come down to deliver them. Go thou and say to the strength of my house, to your tents, O Israel, build up the wastes and raise up the foundation of desolation that this generation has made." This is last day's language that is being applied to Joseph when the Lord is going to come down and deliver. On the wings of an eagle shall my brother be carried beyond all harm. There's no way that that applied at Carthage in 1844.
Yeah, and even going back, ever faithful to his friends and true to his word. Joseph had a rough spot shortly after this. By 1838, he was on the outs with Oliver, with David Whitmer. You go down the list. In Nauvoo, he was saying one thing and doing something entirely different. So, I don't think that applies to the Joseph in the 1830s and 1840s. But if you subscribe to the idea that he is coming back, then this would seem to apply to that second commission.
"Thus shall he be honored of the Lord, and thus shall it be recorded of him, that the generations to come may bless his name in Israel, saying, The Lord make thee as Joseph the seer, who is of the house of Ephraim, the brother of Manasseh. The Lord do thee good and bring peace and blessing upon thy house, as he brought them upon the house of Joseph the seer, who was raised up of a choice vine from the stem of Jacob through the root of Joseph, even that Joseph who was separated from his brethren. For like Joseph of old shall he be. He shall save the just from desolation by the wise counsel of the Almighty. For by his direction shall they gather into storehouses and barns till they overflow with the richness of the fruit of the harvest. And by this means shall the just be saved from famine, while the nations of the wicked are distressed and faint." So if we believe this to be prophetic, we have to believe that Joseph's going to come back and he is going to instruct us to prepare for that day when there's going to be a great famine and presumably to flee to Zion. Again, very last days, apocalyptic language in preparation for the Lord's coming when great desolation is going to fall upon the earth.
Yeah, and that just continues in the next one. "In due time, he shall go forth to the north, and by the power of his word shall the deep begin to give way and the ice melt before the sun." Well, we can read about that in section 45. "By the keys of the kingdom shall he lead Israel into the land of Zion." Wait, I thought he went to Zion in 1831 and dedicated it. Why is Oliver in 1835 saying this is going to happen in the future?
Rhetorical question. Next.
He goes and quotes some scripture here, but then he says, the lame shall leap as a hart, the old shall renew his strength, and the virgin of Israel with the youth shall exalt the name of our God upon harps and instruments of tenth strings. They're all referring back to Isaiah's prophecies about the millennial reign when peace covers the earth and we're in that state. Oliver seems to be saying Joseph is going to be the one that leads us to that and leads us into that Zion.
Yeah, you make a great point, because there are lots of allusions to ancient prophecies about the last days, especially Isaiah. Even this reference to being hid under the pavilion of the Lord Jehovah, or in this next section, it says, he shall be a sure arrow in the bow of his God, for he shall be hid under the shadow of his wing. His loins shall be like iron girded by the hand of the Lord, and his feet shall be swift to execute the commandment of the Most High when he shall say, destroy. His name shall be had in everlasting remembrance, and his name seed after him. So there's an insertion of the word seed there. For they shall be saved to the utmost. So again, it's linking Joseph essentially to those ancient prophecies about this last great prophet prior to Christ's return.
And it just goes on. His fame shall be sounded in foreign lands, even to the ends of the earth, as well as nigh at home. For in this the time shall change. A prophet shall have honor in his own country. Now I could see where a TBM would say, oh, well, we're teaching everyone around the world about Joseph Smith and what he did in the past. But he goes on. His learning and wisdom shall astonish the great. For they shall acknowledge that by his intelligence he has far surpassed their learning and their science. In palaces of governors, rulers, and kings shall he be honored, even in his person, for God shall give him power to prevail. He shall be a lawgiver to Israel, and shall teach the house of Jacob the statutes of the Most High. His testimony shall shine like the sun, and the weight of his influence shall be like the great river that rises on the east of the lasting hills and flows into the great deep. So shall his righteousness ever abound.
That hasn't happened. You don't have scientists and scholars saying, oh, how wise you are, Joseph. You know, quite the opposite today.
Personally, I think that, you know, a lot of the things Joseph said back in the 1830s and 40s weren't necessarily inspired. And so there's no reason for people to be astonished by them. But the scriptures do tell us that at the last days, this servant of the Lord will go forth preaching truth, unadulterated truth, and that is going to astonish everyone. It's easy to say, yeah, the stuff he said before doesn't fit this criteria, but this is talking about an end time scenario, not the 1840s.
And even more comes of this. He shall partake of the blessings of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the chief things of the ancient mountains, the precious things that couch beneath, and of the treasures hid in the sand, the records of past ages and generations, and the histories of ancient days shall he bring forth. Even the record of the Nephites shall he again obtain, with all those hidden up by Mormon and others who are righteous, and many others, till he is overwhelmed with knowledge. No precious thing shall slumber from his possession, for he shall be covered with the most choice of all ages, till his soul shall be satisfied, and his heart shall say, enough, enough.
There's more than just the vision of the brother of Jared that needs to be revealed. There's lots of other records that need to come forth. And again, this seems to be saying that Joseph is going to be the one that brings those forth.
Yes, not somebody else in Brazil who suddenly has access to the sealed portion of the records. We're laughing because many of you will know that there's somebody in Brazil who claims to have access to the sealed portion. In his hands shall the Urim and Thummim remain, and the holy ministry, and the keys of the evangelical priesthood, also for an everlasting priesthood forever, even the patriarchal. For behold, he is the first patriarch in the last days. He shall sit in the great assembly and general council of patriarchs, and execute the will and commandment of God under the direction of the Ancient of Days, for he shall have his place and act in his station. So this is an interesting reference to the evangelical priesthood and the patriarchal priesthood. And I had to think a little bit hard about the first patriarch in the last days, since we know that it was his father who was ordained as the first patriarch. But when you realize that we're not in the last days yet, I think this explains that at that point in time, when we actually are in those last days, that he will be the first patriarch.
I like that explanation.
That's how I reconcile that.
Behold, my brother Joseph is blessed. Blessed are all who bless him, and blessed are all those whom he blesses. Multitudes, multitudes shall come to a knowledge of the truth through his ministry, and he shall be welcomed into the presence of kings and the great ones of the earth, for he shall claim his place among the nobles of the earth and shall be reverenced by them. He shall also be filled with the abundance of the fat of the earth. His flock shall bring forth thousands and tens of thousands. His vats shall overflow with wine and oil. His cattle shall increase to a multitude. He shall have horses and mules and asses and she-asses and dromedaries, camels and elephants, and all swift beasts. And when he goes forth in haste, his chariot shall roar like the approach of an army. He shall have gold and silver, precious stones, diamonds, pearls, and the pure platinum with the antiquities of every kind. Joseph Smith died in bankruptcy.
That's the pipe dream of his generation, right? To have cattle and elephant, you know, all these things of the earth. I don't think that any true servant of the Lord is really going to care about those things, but the Lord pours out his abundant blessings upon those who serve him. And it seems like Joseph will have a chance at obtaining those things when he returns in righteousness.
I specifically link this to the conditions in Zion. When there's just so much abundance, everyone is going to be that way. No one's going to want for anything, and we'll have all things in common. And so, I don't think this is.
It's just a collective blessing, right? It's a collective.
Just a billionaire. I think it's just the blessings of Zion.
Right. Yeah. He's not going to be the Jeff Bezos of Zion, right? Thus shall God bless, and thus shall he be prospered, and he shall have peace after a little. For his enemies shall be consumed, many of them, and many shall turn and be his friends in very deed. He shall remain to a good old age, even till his head is like the pure wool. Behold, there is no end to the vision of the multiplicity of blessings and glories which shall come upon my brother Joseph. He shall possess a mansion on high and have an inheritance in that city which is like pure gold, even like transparent glass. His rest shall be glorious, and his name remain forever. Thus closes the vision, and thus it shall be, even so, amen. So like you said, it's unclear whether Joseph was here at the time. I suspect not. Oliver had been fasting and praying and saw this vision and wrote it down. I've not found anything that says that Joseph reacted to this. I suppose he read it. It was recorded in a church patriarchal blessing book, which he had access to. But have you ever found anything along those lines?
Nope, I haven't.
No. And again, all this language is last days, right before Christ comes and Joseph returning. And I think it's another evidence of his return sitting here in our history.
I guess if I were to show this to a true believing Mormon, I would say, you know, reconcile this with your interpretation that Joseph's work is done and now he's exalted and sitting on his throne. Was this a false vision?
Oh, it was Oliver. Come on.
But it was Oliver in 1835, right before he went into the Kirtland Temple and saw God. Can't sit there and say, well, he was wicked and corrupt in September, but righteous and pure in March.
Very good points. I believe this is a true vision. I believe that Joseph is going to return, and what Oliver saw here is going to be fulfilled by Joseph in the last days. It's not the only evidence of that. We've gone over in great detail, and I've written an entire chapter in my book about the return of the servants and all the evidence of that. And this is just one piece of a bigger puzzle of evidence that points in that direction. So thanks for putting this on the list to cover, because I imagine that most of our listeners have not taken the opportunity to really delve into this particular blessing. And it can be found in the Joseph Smith Papers Project online under the date September 22nd, 1834. And this just hit me. Amazing things happened in church history back in the 1830s on the autumnal equinox. And September 22nd, the fall equinox. I mean, that's when Moroni came to teach Joseph every year. It was on the autumnal equinox that he came. And here we have this blessing that is provided on that exact same date of the year. Interesting from a Gee Whiz perspective, but consistent.
That's my bailiwick. Quit stepping on my turf.
But the Gee Whiz?
Yeah. All right. Taylor, what are we going to do next week?
We're going to continue in history with something we find on November 3rd, the 12 are under condemnation. November 9th, the Second Commission. November 12th, where we learn that an endowment is needed to preach the gospel. And then we'll try to cover 108 and 137. So again, we're going in chronological order, but this will set us up to then talk about the dedication of the Kirtland Temple the week after that. I would suggest that our listeners go to the Joseph Smith Papers Project and look at these various documents starting November 3rd and continuing until April. There are three or four of them that are important to understand. I can't emphasize enough, if you want to get some really good data from the history of the church, this is the time when there's just tons of stuff that will just teach you about the true endowment and what they were looking forward to at the Kirtland Temple. Still a lot of really dense spiritual experiences and writings and teachings that come out of this period of time. So take the opportunity, listeners, to go dig in this kind of 6-month time period leading up to the dedication of the Kirtland Temple.
Well, with that, we'll call it quits this week. Thank you, everyone. Have a great week, and we'll catch you next time on the Iron Rod Podcast.